Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Before we start talking with Diane Ravitch, a thank you to all of you who contributed to the Wisconsin Public Radio Pledge Drive. It was a half the time pledge drive, and it worked. We had 9,500 listeners pledge, 2,600 new members, and you donated over $1 million to fund Wisconsin Public Radio. I know it's hard for many people to find the money to do that these days, and you did it, and thank you. We'll do our job. We can't do it without you. We'll carry on now. Diane Ravitch is joining us. Actually, I can't remember how this came about. Somebody, I think on an open line, said, why don't you look at what's going on in Finland in terms of education? We do a lot of education shows, and we thought that would be interesting because they seem to be doing very well. And Diane Ravitch wrote a very interesting piece on her examination of the Finnish school system, and she's joining us this hour. She's a research professor of education at New York University, a historian of education. She is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. She shares a blog that is titled Bridging Differences, and she was Assistant Secretary of Education and Counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of President George Herbert Walker Bush. She was responsible for the Office of Educational Research and Improvement in the U.S. Department of Education. She, for a number of years, was a member of the National Assessment Governing Board. She is the author of many, many publications and books, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, which was published last year. She has lectured in Poland, the former Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, Romania, the former Soviet Union, the former Yugoslavia, Germany, Japan, Nicaragua, and throughout the United States. And she has become really a foremost education analyst in this country, and she's changed her mind about a number of issues, which makes her, in addition, she's very smart, but it also makes her very interesting. So she writes in Education Week, this was in October, that she just got back from a trip to Europe. And the highlight of her trip was visiting schools in Finland. And of course, Finland, she says, is much in the news these days because of its success on the Program for International Student Assessment Examinations. For the past decade, 15-year-old Finnish students have consistently been at or near the top of all the nations tested in reading, mathematics, and science. And yet you'll be flabbergasted to learn how few tests are given to Finnish students. There's just a whole different culture in Finnish education, and we'll talk about that with Deborah this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I assume we're going to have many on this issue, which is of vital importance to all of us. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655 for you to join us. Diane Ravitch, a pleasure to be able to speak with you this morning. Hello. Thank you.
Well, good morning. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. So this came up in an open line, and we thought it would be, and I was so glad that you were the person who had gone to Finland. You write that what makes the Finnish school system so amazing is that Finnish students never take a standardized test until their last year of high school.
That's correct.
That's unbelievable.
They do take tests, but the tests are the ones made by their own teachers who know them best. But they don't take standardized tests. We're now spending billions of dollars every year on standardized tests. This is this era we're in, the No Child Left Behind era, is a bonanza for testing companies like Pearson and McGraw-Hill, particularly Pearson.
Mm-hmm. How did we get into this era where we're testing kids all the darn time when so many people say we've got problems with this, particularly teachers and parents and students?
Well, we have many problems. I think right now there's this focus on it's all the teacher's fault, and that's ridiculous. We have a popular culture that's deeply anti-educational. We have many parents who don't get involved as they should be with students. We have many students who are more engaged with what they see on television than their schoolwork. We have these terrible assessments that actually, in my view, crush creativity and originality. And we're turning school into a place of, it's the kingdom of boredom. because everything now is about the test scores. There was a time about 100 years ago in our schools, and I'm a historian of education, about 100 years ago the testing obsession began because the idea was that we were entering into the industrial age and students had to learn to be compliant factory workers, and so they needed this discipline of being tested and tested and tested. But eventually we gave up on that, and a different emphases came into play, not just testing. We're now back into preparing kids for the early 20th century, not for the 21st century. What we need, and I think that everybody in the business world will say this, they talk about the need to have people who think for themselves, who are innovative, entrepreneurial, ingenious, et cetera. None of that is being encouraged by all the emphasis on testing. And it doesn't seem to be something that we're going to get away from anytime soon, because all of our politicians seem to be wedded to the idea that you cannot trust a teacher, you cannot trust a principal,
right.
You cannot trust anybody. What the testing about at bottom is simply a lack of trust. And we have to check everybody all the time.
In so many states, we're taking away the right for students, for teachers to be able to help design education in a way to figure out how long school days are going to be and how to deal with classrooms, that we're reverting more to this top-down kind of model.
Well, definitely. The current approach is that we should look to Congress to tell us how to reform schools. We should look to the state legislature.
Yes.
Now, if there are any two agencies that know less about schooling than, let's say, kindergarten children, it would be Congress and your state legislature. So why they're designing teacher evaluation systems, why they're deciding how to reform schools when there's nobody in any of those bodies who's ever actually done any of this and knows anything about it, it's simply bizarre. And no other country, none of the top-performing nations in the world would dream of turning over to their national parliament a decision about how to reform their schools.
I like your description, and it's so different than our atmosphere in the United States. When you talk to teachers and principals in Finland, they said trust is the key here. Parents trust teachers because they're professionals. Teachers trust one another and collaborate to solve mutual problems because they are professionals. Teachers and principals trust one another. It's trust.
Yes, and this is what I was told. I visited many schools. I talked to principals, teachers. I spoke to education researchers. I spoke to people who prepare teachers. I talked to the head of a parent association. Everyone talked about our teachers are professionals. They don't need standardized tests. Why would we rely on standardized tests to tell us what we expect them to know every day? Now, and again, that doesn't mean they don't give tests, but their tests are made in the school by the teachers.
They do have, and tell me more about this, you say a national curriculum, certain areas that all students must study.
Yes. Well, the idea of a national curriculum there is it's to make sure that all students get the arts. What's now being promoted nationally by the Obama administration is simply reading and math, and schools may decide to drop the arts, as they're deciding right now all over the country, in places like Wisconsin, where there have been dramatic budget cuts, in places like Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida. Kids are not getting physical education, they're not getting the arts, they're not getting history, they're cutting back on time for civics, foreign languages. None of this is good education. So the finished curriculum is a guarantee that all children, wherever they are, will have the absolute necessities, the essentials of a good education. But what the national curriculum does not do is it doesn't tell teachers how to teach, and it doesn't even say this is your lesson plan for today. It leaves to teachers the professionalism that you would expect every teacher to have, because they've all had 5 years of preparation. Now, what we're doing in this country, unlike Finland, is we're actually lowering standards for entry into teaching. There are states now that are accepting an online degree where the so-called teacher has never even met a student, and yet they get this online degree and poof, you're a teacher. Teach for America, which has lots of good things about it because it attracts very smart young people, they have 5 weeks of training. Well, the Finns simply couldn't understand the idea of why you would allow someone to teach with 5 weeks of training. That seemed to them impossible. How could you possibly be a good teacher with 5 weeks of training?
Right. It's such an important job, and people should prepare for it, and most of them do, as we know. They prepare for it, and they care about these students, and they go the extra mile, and Why the heck they're not treated with much more respect is beyond me when it affects all of us. We're parents. We all went to school. We're going to get jobs. Schools create the fabric of American society as it is and how it will be. It's just a crucial part of America.
Right. I mean, what's happening today is simply a disgrace. There is now a national movement to, on the one, it's hypocrisy. On the one hand, to talk about school reform, and we hear this endlessly, reform, 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 which usually means, what they usually mean by school reform is fire teachers. And then, at the same time, we have a massive disinvestment going on across the country, where state after state is cutting the budget for public education.
Yes, right.
And opening up the schools for exploitation by business interests to create privately managed schools, to create for-profit opportunities for online companies. And so we'll see more and more online ventures, online charters, like online cyber charters, where kids don't actually interact with the teacher except on a computer screen. This is a huge moneymaker, and there are a lot of people. There's now a whole new field called educational entrepreneurship where people are looking at this sector and saying there's profit to be made here.
Oh, really? They would look for profit in education?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Google Education right. Entrepreneurs, one of them would be Rupert Murdoch,
right.
Who just bought a tech company, and he said when he bought it, he sees a $500 billion industry. Wow, that's a lot of money to be made.
Yeah. Oh, why go to school? Let's just all do it online in our pajamas.
Well, sure, and you know, the problem here is there are, in fact, actually, there are some wonderful online programs and applications that can be used in the classroom. And there may be some kids who live very distant, and the only way they'll ever have a physics class is online. But what's happening is the development of online schools where they enroll students. This is true in higher education. It's also true in K-12 education. The schools enroll the students, collect full tuition, and then there's a huge dropout rate. There was just a story from Colorado about Colorado having spent $100 million on online schools, and then noticing that the attrition rate was enormous because after the tuition had been collected, many of the students simply disappeared.
Yeah. You've done some interesting studies because we hear these stories and we believe them to be true. What happened in certain New Orleans districts after Hurricane Katrina, how the schools are better than ever, the charter schools, the schools that President Obama has touted in Colorado where, poor schools do terrific. Look at their test scores. And you've done some investigative reporting that shows that the truth is quite different.
Well, you know, the truth about school is that it's hard work. Teachers work very hard. And you know, this current claim that we have so many bad teachers and lazy teachers and we need to fire teachers, the fact is that 50% of the people who start teaching are gone within 5 years, and many of them got fired. So this is a very hard job, and education takes place day by day and year by year. And when you see somebody make a claim that a school or that an entire district made some dramatic test score gain, you really have to be skeptical. And I've been hearing, as we all have, about New Orleans being a miracle district. And there, I have various bloggers who have done the research, sent it to me, and showed, for example, and the people in New Orleans know this is true, the New Orleans Recovery School District, amongst the 70 districts in Louisiana, is ranked 69 out of 70. So it's made gains, but the gains are from an incredibly low baseline. In fact, most of the schools in that Recovery School District in New Orleans, 87% of them got a D or an F from the
Ooh.
State of Louisiana. So there's a lot of hype in this, and the hype comes from people with a political agenda. The political agenda is they want more charters, more privatization. They want to get rid of the unions, make sure that teachers have no rights and no seniority and no tenure, and then that will produce a miracle, except that if you look to the right-to-work states, which are mostly in the South, you don't see any miracle there. In fact, the highest-performing states in the country are Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, all of which have strong unions. And Finland, in fact, not only has a strong union, all of its teachers and principals together belong to the same union. So unions themselves don't stop high achievement. Other things are more important, and I would say the most important would be making sure that children come to school healthy and ready to learn.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much child poverty in this country that this is the elephant in the room. This is what the so-called reformers don't want to talk about, is that almost one out of four children in the United States of America is living in poverty. And that's way ahead of any country in Europe or in Asia. We find ourselves, in terms of child poverty, ranking only behind Turkey, Mexico, and Poland in the world that participates in these international assessments. We should not be comparing ourselves to Turkey, Mexico, and Poland. I mean, these are very poor countries, and why should we, the richest nation in the world, have close to one out of four children living in poverty? That has a huge impact on education, because children arrive in kindergarten on their first day of school far, far behind. The achievement gap is not created in school. It's created in the home.
And as you mentioned, in Finland, and this may be a real key point here, that the poverty rate, because they have a strong welfare, social welfare system, is 4%.
Right. 4% or less for children. And, you know, this is not by accident. And Finland is not a socialist country. Finland is a capitalist country that is dedicated to having a decent society. In fact, the goal of their education system is, and this is a shocking thought, the United States of America, to develop the humanity of every child.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that? To develop the humanity of every child.
I'd like to imagine it,
and,
yes.
And what they hold is their values in the education system are equity, creativity, and prosperity. Now, I would go for that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Diane Ravitch is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have our phone lines are jammed, but keep this number ready. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. She has a lengthy, lengthy bio. She's a historian of education, an educational policy analyst, a research professor at NYU's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development, and she is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education in the President George Herbert Walker Bush administration. Here's our, oh, I gave you the number. All right, we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now, starting with Connie in Manitowoc. Hi, Connie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I appreciate your topic today. Having led a study tour to Finland to look at their rise to be one of the most competitive nations in the world, one of the things we did look at was their education. And so this, your guest's comments I find very interesting. And some of the distinctions that we noticed in our exploration were, one, the common vision, and your guest has kind of touched on that as well, is almost every entity, agency, educational institution that we visited, they all had a very strong ability to communicate a common vision that they had for the country, and looked at a triple helix approach of business, education, and government in partnership to make that vision come true. And a couple of other elements of the education, particularly that we noticed being different than what you see in the U.S., were education system that utilized project learning to a very large degree, and that they don't start school at all until they're 7 years old, which is much different than we keep putting that age lower and lower in our education system. They also had, there's also free education through actually achieving your doctorate degree. Another element we saw in the educational system was that they also educate for how do you apply this learning to advance, say, business ideas, innovation, prosperity in the nation. And then one of the most distinct comments we heard, or interesting comments, was that in talking to different entities in the country, was that in Finland, they don't even look at themselves as a country, per se, because of the it's smaller than many. It's about the same size as Wisconsin and same population. And mm-hmm. They said, we actually look at ourselves as a club.
All right, let's get a response. Diane.
Well, I think there's a lot there that I would agree with. First of all, what is staggering to hear in Finland is that higher education is free. And the reason I say it's staggering is I just yesterday saw that the lead story in USA Today was that the biggest bubble now facing our economy is $1 trillion of student debt, and how this will burden our society for the next generation, because young people who are burdened with tens of thousands of dollars of debt are going to hesitate about buying a home, hesitate about buying a new car, and it's going to hurt the economy. And yet no one seems to care that we are crushing this whole generation and, in essence, denying higher education to many who are terrified of taking this debt on and ruining their lives. And yet in Finland, when they told me that higher education was paid for by the government, I said, that's incredible. They said, but it's because education is a basic human right. Just as you do not charge people to go to elementary or secondary school, you don't charge them for higher education either. That's a government responsibility. So, you know, the taxes are high. It's something we hate here, the idea of taxes. But, you know, it makes a huge difference. Now, the kids do learn a lot through projects and activities. The other thing I noticed in visiting schools is the importance of the arts. In every school that I went to, kids were singing and dancing. And in between classes, every single class, there was a 15-minute recess where they basically said to the kids, run outside and play.
Yeah.
And they had that time just to kind of blow off steam.
Mm-hmm.
We're going in the opposite direction. We think that we're copying, I guess, some Asian country where it's test, work, longer school day, longer school year, start earlier, end later, and keep your nose to the grindstone. And, you know, that's such a bad formula. Even the Asian nations right now are trying to figure how to break free of this, what they call the testing hell. So it's hard to understand how our policymakers think this is going to improve our society. We became a great nation because we treasured innovation, ingenuity, letting people be free to dream up new ideas, and now we're forcing everyone into the same mold. And it's just so wrong, and it's happening in Wisconsin. It's happening across this country.
Thanks, Connie. Jackie and Drummond, hi.
Well, yeah, you kind of hit on some of my topics, but when I first heard, you know, that this topic, I always think when we compare ourselves to European countries, whether it's education, medical care, or whatever, it's an unrealistic comparison, because as the other caller said, you'd be better just talking about Wisconsin and Finland, because I just checked on Google, and Finland has 5 million people, and the United States is 306 million and rising. And also, I was wondering if Finland is more of a homogeneous country. You know, we're an immigrant country. My son teaches ESL. Sometimes they'll have 30 different languages. So I do think it's really hard to, you know, discuss, you know, these two countries. And also, with our high poverty rate, lack of parental involvement, these are things that will never help our education if we can change some of this. And I just, you know, get really discouraged, you know, when we have all these issues and, you know, federal cutback and everything. So I'd like you to address comparing the sizes.
Sure. Well, the important thing to bear in mind is that Finland is a small country, but it is larger than 30 states. So a state like Wisconsin, for example, could do everything that Finland is doing if there were the will to do it and if the federal government would actually stop requiring all this mandated testing. And I think that there are schools in Finland that have a lot of diversity. There was an article recently in the Smithsonian by a writer named Linnell Hancock, who's an experienced education writer. And she asked specifically to go to schools that had a lot of diversity. And she went to schools where 30 or 40% of the kids were not Finnish. And she came away, she said, with tears in her eyes at the excitement that the children had about learning, about the arts, about the way teachers were treated with respect. So it is a different culture, but you know, if we want to improve our schools, we should learn from a variety of models and not just try to turn our schools into a replication of the penal system.
Hmm. You talk about, and there is a stronger and stronger movement to evaluate teachers in this country by how well their students perform on these massive numbers of tests. You write in your piece that Finnish educators were astonished by that idea. And when we think about it individually, Diane, those teachers who really made a difference in most of our lives were people who got us excited about, you know, Charles Dickens, or
right.
thought we had a proclivity in a certain area and urge us to use our skills in that area. It wasn't. It had nothing to do with test scores.
No,
nothing.
I know. I wrote a book that came out last year, and it just this week is coming out in paperback, and I wrote a new last chapter in which I review all the current research about this crazy idea of evaluating teachers by test scores. And all the current research reaches the same conclusion, which is all these methods that are now being adopted by state after state that are being promoted by the Obama administration and by Race to the Top, that they're wrong, that they will identify misidentified teachers, that some who are absolutely spectacular teachers will be called ineffective,
right.
And others who are just boring, drill-down, test teachers
mm-hmm.
will be called great teachers when they're not great at all. And they're also, these measures are also very unstable. Someone who is effective one year will be ineffective the next year. So we're taking a very unprofessional, mechanistic approach based on test scores that in many cases are derived from flawed measures and cheating, statistical error, random error. I mean, you could just go on with all the errors in the testing and saying, why are we doing this to our teachers? This is so demoralizing. Over this past year and a half, I've probably talked to, I don't know, well over 100,000 people, many of them teachers. And people say to me, I've been a teacher for 20 years. I've gotten award after award. I'm quitting. I can't stand all of this
negative
comment.
Isn't that terrible? Yeah. I know.
So we are demoralizing teachers. We should be moving in a direction of saying this is one of the hardest jobs in our country.
Right.
We don't pay teachers enough. And we should find ways. Sure, we could pay teachers more to do more. Those who become mentors, those who do additional jobs in the school should make more money. But don't base the pay on test scores. Don't base the evaluation on test scores. All that does is to incentivize cheating, teaching to the test, and narrowing the curriculum. When the arts should not be tested, and when the arts don't matter, then they get dropped. We are today in this country closing libraries, firing social workers, firing guidance counselors, eliminating the arts, eliminating physical education. There are some schools that have it once a week or actually have virtual physical education where kids are given a CD and told to go home and do it on the television.
Oh, my gosh.
On their home screen. We are in a period of massive disinvestment in public education, and at the same time, the for-profit sector is growing. So there is a very, we're at a dangerous time in our education system. And I think that the reason that I was so impressed with Finland is not only because they've been incredibly successful without standardized tests, but because it holds up a vision of what can be accomplished by respecting teachers, by treating each child with dignity, and by a whole different vision. I'm not suggesting we can copy Finland, because we can't, but we certainly shouldn't be copying countries that are doing the wrong things, and we just seem to be in a downward spiral of test. And in fact, this is the status quo. We've now had 10 years of No Child Left Behind, and I would venture to say you'd find few people who think it's been successful. In fact, we're on track now to labeling every school in this country a failure based on No Child Left Behind. And what I've noticed, and, you know, I've traveled a lot around the world, there's no country in the world where the national legislative body has passed a law that labeled every school in the country to be a failure. I mean, this is just a way of destroying public education and making it ripe for privatization.
Hmm. Brad in Milwaukee. Hi, Brad. Are you there, Brad? Brad is not there, so let's go to Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guests. I consider myself very fortunate. I got into education nearly 50 years ago, and I got out, too, about 20 years ago. But when I first started teaching, about the only tests I ever did were spelling tests. But what I did do to offset those not doing the tests was I had the kids go back and make their corrections, but I also had the time. I had a small enough class sizes where I could have each one make the corrections and I could look at them. And as a result, come spring of the year on their assessment test, I mean, they did very well. But I stayed away. I just played flat. I didn't like them anyways, and I just stayed away from them. And nobody got on my case about it much, particularly after I did well on their assessment test in the spring. But your guest mentioned recesses. I remember going to school right after World War II from first grade to fourth grade. We had a half an hour in the morning and another half an hour in the afternoon, plus a half an hour for lunch. And all of us came out very well. We just had a lot of fun. We snowball fights in a country school, fox and goose, pump pull away, and softball.
Diane.
Well, we, you know, we created a great country by giving teachers the freedom to teach and by having kids have some, you know, some fun at school, enough time for recess, a regular program of physical education. Of course, you know, I believe in giving spelling tests. I was always really good at spelling tests, so I thought they were great. But I think that the important thing is that the teacher himself or herself needs to be the one to do the checking. We now have state departments of education and a national department of education where people from the business world and people who have never actually spent any time in a classroom are making decisions about how to evaluate teachers. And this is wrong. I mean, what's happened is we've taken the locus of control of the teacher's work out of the teacher's hands, out of the school itself, and shifted it to the state capitol, to the legislature, and now to the Congress. And we're going to lose the very thing. We're going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And that's the American belief in freedom and ingenuity and creativeness. And, you know, of course, the federal government, I'm not against the federal government supporting the schools that need help the most, and I'm talking now about money, not about direction and control and giving out mandates. We need the federal money to level the playing field for those districts that are very poor and for those kids that need extra help. But we must retain the professionalism of our teachers.
I'm worried about the future of the profession. I don't know if you've seen any studies or if anybody is studying how all of this demoralization, teachers making less money, not having as much say in their workplace environment, what effect it's going to have on the number of young people who would choose this as a profession, Diane?
Well, I haven't seen studies. I expect there will be studies, but I can tell you again from having spent the last year and a half talking to many thousands of teachers, the extent of demoralization across the country is profound because we've had now a steady drumbeat of negative portrayals of teachers in Waiting for Superman, which was a propagandistic pro-privatization film, very anti-teacher. It showed lazy teachers. It showed terrible schools, and the only hope seemed to lie in privatization. So it was interesting to me to discover that that film was largely funded by a billionaire who has also funds a lot of these pro-voucher, pro-privatization think tanks.
Hmm.
But there's a lot of money out there, and this is something else I've learned. A lot of people who are multimillionaires and billionaires investing in the disestablishment of the teaching profession and lowering standards for entering teaching and also in privatizing public education. And I was recently in North Carolina and South Carolina, and they named the billionaires there who were supporting these anti-public education agendas. I was in Kansas just yesterday, and there they have the Koch brothers. I guess you have the Koch brothers in Wisconsin as well. Others have different billionaires. But the whole emphasis seems to be on removing the public from public education and changing education from a public service into some kind of a marketplace competitive commodity where parents become consumers and children become products and teachers are at-will employees with no rights. Their salaries are arbitrarily set by the management and they can be fired for any reason at all. So this is demoralizing to teachers, and I've heard again and again about young people saying, I don't know if I should become a teacher because I wanted to teach poor kids, and I'm afraid that if I teach in a school where the poor kids are, the school will be closed, and I'll be out of a job, or I'll be stigmatized as someone who taught in a failing school. This is part of the whole federal approach right now. It's embedded in the Bush-era No Child Left Behind law and also in Arne Duncan's Race to the Top. This idea that you label a school a failing school, and then instead of giving it any help, instead of actually evaluating what the problems are and trying to solve them, you either fire the principal, then you fire half the staff or all the staff, you close the school, you turn it into a charter, or you start all over with a whole bunch of new people, and most of the new people will be somebody who got fired someplace else. So it's really a terrible, terrible approach to education, and I don't know of any country in the world that's taking these punitive steps.
I don't fully understand, Diane, how you can mess around with one of the pillars of American democracy, which is public education, without a huge hue and cry. And I know that teachers are very concerned, and we've had massive demonstrations in the state of Wisconsin and in other states. But I don't know how, considering that most of us are products of fine public education and we got to where we got to because of our teachers and public schools and everybody having access to good education, how can you mess up something that is so important to a country?
You know, what's happened is so cynical that it's almost beyond belief. And these ideas stem, first of all, from very conservative think tanks that believe in the free market and don't believe in public education. But they have crept into the public dialogue, but it's always somebody else's school. So when you hear about a school being closed somewhere, you don't think too much about it because it's not your school, but eventually it will be your school. And by the time it reaches your district and your school, you think, gosh, you know, this is the way it is and there's nothing I can do about it. And I live in New York City, and here the mayor has total control, and he's closed 100 or 200 public schools and replace them with lots of other little schools and charter schools, and parents and kids come out by the thousands to protest, but he doesn't care. You know, there's no accountability. But what we're seeing is a well-funded, well-coordinated attack on public education. The language is carefully massaged, so you have people, when they talk about the strategy, they talk about choice. What they don't mention is that choice means privatization. If they had said, we plan to privatize your local public schools, there would be an outcry. But instead, they say, you're going to get choice. What they don't tell you is the choice may be worse than what you've got now. There have been many studies of charters, and I can tell you from the studies of vouchers in Milwaukee, the kids are doing no better. In the charter sector, which is now over 5,000 schools, there has been evaluation after evaluation. It says the charter schools on the whole are no better than regular public schools, and yet what they are is they're privately managed. We're turning over public funds to private charter operators, some of whom will do a good job, some of whom will do a horrible job, and on the whole will do no different a job. In terms of vouchers in Milwaukee, the kids are no better off today than they were 20 years ago. Vouchers started in Milwaukee in 1990, 21 years ago, so they've had a good long run. And the evaluations of the charter of the voucher program and Milwaukee showed that the kids in the voucher school do no better than the kids in the public school, and they're all doing terribly. The African-American children in the voucher schools, as well as in the public schools, are performing on par with their African-American peers in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, the poorest, lowest-performing states in the country. So vouchers have been a disaster, and yet your legislature and your governor is expanding them to more schools and lifting the income limits on vouchers.
Yeah. Oh, they say the parents are so much happier with those voucher schools.
That's about all they
That's
can
what
say
they
about
say.
Them because
right.
there's no improvement in education. So the question is the goal of education to make parents happy, or is it to improve education? And clearly they have not improved education, but people are getting a choice, and so they think, well, that's good, we got a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the choice in most cases will be to a school that is either no better or actually worse than the neighborhood public school, and where if they don't like your child, if your child is special ed or if your child is a behavior problem, they'll kick them out and send them right back to the regular public mm-hmm. school.
Eugene, thanks for the call. Buck in Madison, hi.
Hello. Two things. One, about why this is so bad, and secondly, about Finland. For the first, this is class warfare against us, and I am intending to go to the conference on ALEC, A-L-E-C, at Fitchburg this weekend. The Koch brothers and all their scions, the 1% who intend to own us all. So look it up on the web. Regarding Finland, here's glancing praise for Finland. You can, and I think this is the only country that does it, listen to the news in Latin. All right?
Didn't know that.
Go on IxQuick, or if you're still stuck with it, go on Google and look up Finland News and Latin, and you'll get it. It is called, let's see, Nuntii, N-U-N-T-I-I, next word, L-A-T-I-N-I, Nuntii Latini, right? And you get to listen to news. I bet this is the prime training ground for people to translate for the Vatican, right? Secondly,
yes, Buck.
We all hate Microsoft, and there is an open source alternative, Linux, L-I-N-U-X, that works just as well, which I have yet to learn, right? But anyway, Linux was invented by a Finn, and it's now a worldwide collaboration of programmers, just like Wikipedia is.
Mm-hmm.
And they just keep fixing things up again and again and making it better and better. And I suspect it is better than Microsoft. These are both products of Finnish education.
Thank you, Buck, very much for the call. Diane.
Yes, what I would say is I don't want anyone to get the impression that the Finnish schools are highly, highly academic. Every school that I went to, the kids were learning in groups. They were doing cooperative learning. They had inclusion classes with kids with disabilities mixed in with kids with regular. They eliminated tracking. I mean, this is a very, very progressive school system. And I know that it's amongst people who are offended by this notion that we can learn something from Finland. They're doing what our best private progressive schools do, where parents are paying tens of thousands of dollars to have their kids engaged in things they actually like doing. And you mentioned earlier the teacher who got you excited about someone like Charles Dickens, the teacher who got you excited in robotics, the teacher who got you excited about history, about wanting to learn everything you could possibly learn about the Ottoman Empire. I mean, those kinds of things are no longer considered important.
Mm-hmm.
All that matters mm-hmm. is, did you pick the right bubble on a standardized test?
Mm-hmm.
We are dumbing down our country. And the previous caller mentioned ALEC, and ALEC is a right-wing legislative group that writes model legislation that's now being adopted in state after state to promote vouchers and charters and to evaluate teachers by test scores. There's another group called Democrats for Education Reform. There are groups like Stand for Children. They all pretend to be terribly interested in poor children, but in fact they all are organizations promoted to taking away any job protections from teachers, de-skilling teaching, deprofessionalizing teaching, making testing the measure of all things, and privatizing education.
You know, and I thought that I've lived in Milwaukee for a long, long time, and I remember when the voucher program started. It seemed to be started by, and I don't want to question their motives, but I will, because all the people who wanted to start these voucher programs hadn't shown a heck of a lot of interest in poor people in Milwaukee ever. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they're champions of, we need to give poor people the same kind of choice that rich people have. And you're thinking, where is your history here?
Right.
What's your history?
Right. Well, the history is, and again, you know, I would refer to in my book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, I have a chapter about choice. And we mustn't forget that the idea of choice was really the platform of the Southern segregationist. And right after the Brown decision in 1954, there was suddenly an upswell of interest in school choice because it would allow white children to choose to leave the public schools and go to white schools. And then the public schools, as they existed, would, you know, whites would choose white schools, blacks would choose black schools. We now see this being resurrected in various forms. There's a group in University of California at Berkeley that's a civil rights project where they say the charter schools are more segregated than the regular public schools. And just the other day in Wake County, North Carolina, they had an election where the citizenry rejected a school board that wanted to eliminate desegregation. The school board wanted to go back to patterns where the white kids went to the white schools and the black kids would be isolated in black schools. And the citizenry voted out all of the school board members who were trying to get rid of this very successful desegregation plan. This wasn't even a busing plan. This was just zoning that made sure that there were no racially isolated schools, and a Tea Party board won the last election, but just about 10 days ago, they were thrown out. Most of them were thrown out, so this is good news. I suspect that what's happening now is this. Whenever vouchers have been put to a public referendum, they lose. They're no longer being put to public referendum for that reason. What you see instead is very wealthy people from foundations, from different organizations like ALEC, instead investing in legislative campaigns, investing in the campaign in Denver, investigating in the school board race in Louisiana, where there's a lot of money at play in the Carolinas. And instead of going to the people and having a vote on whether or not they want their money to go to non-public schools, they're simply investing in the campaign of legislators who will put those things through without taking it to the people. The people don't want to lose their public schools. The people of this country understand that public education is one of the greatest, most important democratic institutions in our history.
Right.
And we have legislators today who don't agree with that.
Yeah. Diane Ravitch is our guest, and her book, which is, she just said, available now in paperback this week, her latest book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. She's a research professor of education at NYU, historian of education, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. She shares a blog titled Bridging Differences, with Deborah Meyer, hosted by Education Week, and she also blogs for Politico.com and the Huffington Post. Her articles have appeared in many, many newspapers and magazines. She has become the go-to person who gives a keen, as you can tell, analysis of what's going on in education and the threats to public education these days. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next call from Stephanie in Green Bay. Hi.
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 I just wanted to make a side comment about all this, the education we're talking about and the government control. And I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, a big, big issue is the fall of the family in this country. I mean, there is no family structure anymore. There is no respect from kids to parents, from kids to teachers. It's just, it's gone completely out of control, where we don't have kids respecting, saying whatever they want, wearing whatever they want, watching whatever they want, reading whatever they want. And
all right, Diane.
Yeah, well, it's part of, if you were to do a larger analysis of what are the problems of education, you would talk about the decimation of the family and about the incredible freedom that children have to watch what they want and do what they want. And any teacher that you meet these days will tell you about the kids who curse them out or who threaten them, and particularly at the high school level, even in the junior high school level. And yet, the public, what we hear from Arne Duncan, what we hear from many of the legislators and governors is, we're going to hold those teachers accountable, as if there is nothing else that matters in children's behavior or in their test scores other than what the teacher does, which is just ridiculous.
We go to Tom in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to say how glad I am that I was not educated under the No Child Left Behind, because I'm not very good at taking tests. Never have been, and so I didn't do that well in school, but you know, as far as test scores. But something inside of me said, you know, I'm really fairly bright in lots of ways. So give me a research paper to write, and I'll probably get an A on it. I went on finally to get a master's degree, and I did it, you know, through rigorous ethics and education. And I still write every day. I still write occasionally for my journals that I read. And, you know, I'm a fairly bright person, but if I'd have believed the test scores, I would have thought that I was not very bright and not ever going to achieve anything.
Diane.
Yeah, what we have now is an effort to shape a meritocracy based solely on these standardized tests. So what's important to do, in my view, is to make the public aware that these tests are a very flawed measure. These are not barometers or thermometers. They're not a yardstick with 36 inches or a foot ruler with 12 inches. These are social constructions created by humans. They are loaded with error, If it's a yardstick, it's a rubber yardstick, because the testing companies make mistakes. Sometimes the questions are poorly worded. Sometimes there are two answers that are correct, not just one. Sometimes a really smart kid will guess the wrong answer because something else makes more sense than what is allegedly the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
We are forcing children into a kind of box in which you will carry with you this label that says that you can go to college, you can't go to college. You can advance, you can't advance. I mean, this is nonsensical. This is not the way our country became great. This is the way to dumb down the country, actually. And until we demystify the test and make people realize, hey, this is one measure, it's not the best measure, and a lot of really terrific, smart kids are going to do poorly on the test for the reason that your caller said. Even Michelle Obama has said she was a very poor test taker, and she didn't want to be judged by her test scores. Well, she was a lucky woman because she still managed to get into Princeton. But a lot of kids will be denied opportunity in life. And if you wanted to think of what I would consider an almost diabolical scheme against many, many children, because either they may have disabilities, they may have language issues, or they're just not good test takers,
right.
This is that diabolical scheme.
Diane, we're out of time. Thank you for your important voice. Thanks.
Thank you.
Diane Ravitch, we'll have to have her on again. The book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, just been published in paperback. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee, and thank you for listening.